Okay, hello everyone. Nice to be back and giving Cheryl a chance to, I think it's Cheryl, a chance to turn on the recording. So as always, I'll start by just mentioning that this satsang, this time together, is really your time. It's whatever you would like to explore, like to speak about, and so in that respect, I invite questions. You can either type them in or raise your hand and take the mic, and or email me at nirmala@endless-satsang.com. So if a question comes up during the week and you think you might forget it, you can just type it out in an email. And I will get to it when I come back next Wednesday. So I actually did get a question for this week, and I think I will just quickly kind of read through it, just to give us it's a nice starting point for our discussion, especially in light of what was just being spoken about, both somebody's transition and some more serious health problems. Someone wrote me and said, "I moved to Florida to assist my parents in their end of life. My father passed in February, and through our conversation, he was not sure how to let go. He would say, 'I'm not in pain, I'm not sick, why am I still here?' I would tell him he neither has to be in pain or be sick." And then she goes on to say, "It's difficult to share the knowledge of how to let the body go. And I ask that you speak to the topic of death and dying." I asked her to say a little more specifically what was her question, and she wrote some more and talked about her father's experience, and again how it seemed like he could let go of everything else, but then he just couldn't let go of the body itself. And she goes on to say that she has no concerns or issues about his death or death in general. She says, "I've known since 7 years old that we don't die, but I am surrounded by several elderly people who I love and who are declining. Two are from a Course in Miracles group, and I would love to serve and share in facilitating the process. Anything that you may share and bring to light would be wonderful. There may be lost knowledge of how to put the body down, i.e. Indians, Aborigines, and other indigenous tribes." So that was the question. It's kind of specifically about how to assist someone in really letting go of the body at the actual time of death. And then also it sounds like she was inviting me to speak a little bit more generally about death and dying. So I'll speak a little bit about it specifically. And I'll start by saying that I'm not actually that involved with the process of death and dying in my work or in my life. I don't have a lot of direct personal experience, so what I'm sharing will be somewhat limited in that respect, and just take it for what it's worth. It may, you know, how these things work, it may lead to something else that is of great value, and or you may find what I share is valuable. First thing I would point to is just a couple of resources. One is a beautiful book, which is probably still available. Used copies on Amazon, called "Who Dies" by Stephen Levine, and I just think it's a wonderful perspective on the whole process of dying. And then there, of course, are all kinds of, as she mentioned, you know, Native American or other traditions' approaches to dying. And one of the traditions, if you're not familiar with, that has a very long tradition of working in a very profound way with death and dying is the Tibetan tradition, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And you may have heard of the Tibetan Book of Dying, or I think that's the title of the classic long-standing book. But there's also a wonderful book out there called the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and it's another great resource, something that's from like probably 30 years ago or something, so it's funny how you may not be aware of it just because it's been around for so long, but anyways, it's out there, and in fact, We sponsor a website, freespiritualebooks.com. Oh, it says only admins can post a URL. So maybe the assistant can post in freespiritualebooks.com, all one word. That book, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, is on that website, and you can download a PDF of it for free. So that's those are the kind of specific resources that I would point to. Something that's a little bit more general and yet is very specific to the question about letting go. This mysterious thing that we might call surrender or letting go. And that is to point you to maybe check out or explore the Sedona Method. You can just do a Google search for Sedona Method. And in simple terms, though it can be deceptively simple, but in simple terms, the Sedona Method basically gives you a tool of letting go. Just simply, it simply invites that through a series of very simple questions. And if it's engaged in ongoingly, it's almost like it develops the muscle of surrender, that develops the muscle of letting go. And also letting things be, which is actually paradoxically the same thing. If you let something be here, it's the same as letting it go. And ultimately, that's the truest surrender, is when you let everything be just the way it is, and or change just the way it is changing, or leave just the way it is leaving. So there's a similar quality to letting go and letting things be. So again, the Sedona Method is brilliant, really, because it's so simple and so direct. An exploration of that. It gets much more involved as you apply it in the experience of life and in the respect to this question, to apply it in the experience of dying or any kind of loss or profound change in life. So to actually develop that capacity so that it kicks in even when something like death appears is profoundly liberating, profoundly freeing. Personally, I found the Sedona Method very, very helpful. So it's not my background to have a lot to share, but in case those are things that you haven't encountered already, they're all worthwhile. The Who Dies by Stephen Levine, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and then also the Sedona Method. And in speaking about letting go and letting things be, I think it's really, I can say a little bit more, this is now speaking a little more generally, about the process of helping, because that was a big part of the question, was that the person who wrote also has other family members, friends, people that she's close to that are deteriorating, that are seemingly headed, as we all are eventually, towards that experience of dying. And so I'll speak a little bit more generally about the process of helping. And this would be applicable in any situation where there's an impulse to help, an impulse to reach out. And what I'm saying is very general and may be very obvious already, but we all sometimes can benefit from even the simplest reminders. And the first I think key thing whenever we have the opportunity to help others, or the impulse, the inspiration to help others, is to actually to wait to be asked. Sounds so obvious, and yet it's we're all prone to rushing right in where angels dare not tread, and offering our often very profound and helpful advice and assistance, even when it hasn't actually been directly asked for. And so that's always, always a good place to start, is to, it's okay to offer. You don't have to wait till someone asks you to even offer your assistance. It's okay to offer your assistance, but to offer it freely, to offer it without any expectation that they take you up on it. I've known close friends that have died, and I have close friends now that are have serious health problems. And one of the challenges, one of the surprising challenges, is dealing with the huge amount of help that is being offered when you're experiencing something like that. And so, someone who has a potentially fatal illness or just a debilitating illness is constantly being told about some new supplement and some new treatment program and some new process, and you should do this and you should take that and you should find go see this person, go see this doctor, do this kind of meditation, and all very well-meaning and kindly offered. And it's very easy to also, especially for the person receiving all this advice, all these suggestions, it's very easy for it to become overwhelming. And it's also very easy for the people who really deeply care about the person to, be invested in that. You have to do this juicing program that helped my friend heal from the same problem, or whatever suggestion you're invested in. Then it's that challenge to offer it freely. There's a great story about two little Cub Scouts who were at their den meeting. And the scoutmaster asked them to share their good deed for the day. And the first boy raised his hand, said that he had helped a little old lady across the street. And the scoutmaster said, "That's wonderful, that's great, that's just what we had in mind when we suggested you do a good deed every day." And then he asked the second boy, and the second boy said, "I helped that same little old lady across the street." And the scoutmaster said, "Well, that's wonderful, that's great, but I just want to know, why did it take two of you to help this little old lady across the street?" And the second little Cub Scout said, "Well, she didn't want to go." And so that's the challenge when we offer help, is to wait until it's asked for, to be sure that it is what the person themselves really want. And so just to hold that offer of help lightly, so that it's a really, you can follow the lead of the person themselves, because ultimately they of course have all the resources, all the wisdom inside of them. And so if you want them to, engage in some heavy-duty health regimen to cure themselves, and they're ready actually to transition, they're ready to leave, then, it's really their process, their experience that should be primary. And in that same light, there's another level to that, another level of the invitation to really follow the lead of the person. And yet it's to recognize that the thing that's going to have the most impact on anyone you interact with, including someone that you're helping in any way and in any context, including helping someone who's ill or dying. And that is that the thing that's going to have the most impact on anyone you interact with in your whole life is your own state of consciousness. It's your own state of realization, your own where you are experiencing the whole experience from. And that has so much more effect than any information or advice or any process, including the one I mentioned, the Sedona method. The thing that can make that powerful and profound is really just being with someone who is already themselves in a place of surrender. And so every interaction we have with someone who is struggling, someone who, clearly could benefit from our help and our assistance, that actually are an opportunity for us to question within ourselves, what are we holding on to? What are we not letting go of? If I recall it right, it's been a while since I read the book Who Dies, but I think there's a whole section about how easy it is to have in mind an idea of what a person's dying is supposed to be like. Whether it's from movies or spiritual books and spiritual teachings, and we have this image of what a good death is like. And that might not be what that actual person in front of you is either going to experience or even needs to experience in their journey. And so surprisingly, the Sedona method, I mentioned it as a way of helping others, but really it's a means to explore in yourself where you're not letting go, where you're not just letting things be. In the question that someone wrote to me this week, it was pretty clear that she has already done a lot of letting go herself. But especially when we encounter, the death of people or pets or any profound loss that comes very, very close to us, that is an opportunity to find out where we aren't letting go, where we haven't really accepted, where we aren't actually as able as we might like to let that person have their own experience and let it unfold just as it needs to for them. And that's, it's a dance really between your consciousness and their consciousness anytime we interact with anyone, either in a literal helping relationship or just in anytime we actually just are in the same room as someone else. So really, ultimately, the main question always is, what am I holding on to, and what would it mean if I was to let go or let things be in a more profound way? And I'll say a little more about, and again, oh, someone's raised their hand. Good, I'm gonna let them have the mic. Oh, yeah, I see that. I'm gonna release the mic and let Lynn talk.
I didn't mean to rush you. You were starting to say something else. That's why I put my hand down. I didn't want to rush you. But I do have a question, and this is from your perspective. I'm hoping I've come to a place right now where I have an interesting quandary, in that I teach A Course in Miracles. I have many friends who are teachers. I watch a lot of videos of teachers. I listen to a lot of teachers. And I notice that it appears to be two different kinds of teachers, one being persons who have become aware of their true nature and are therefore speaking from a place of truth and source. And then there are many others who are seeking for their true nature and are looking, basically asking or making up, I say making up, I mean, exercises and training and teaching and how to and do this and practice that. And I have a lot of friends who are doing that, and even myself have been venturing into that kind of activity. And I realized, my gosh, I don't know the way, and I'm drawing a map. and I'm giving people instructions of how to get to someplace I've never been or someplace I don't know. And so I'm feeling of the urge to just give up all that kind of activity teaching wise, except other than to read something that I do know or trust as truth, and share what I do know or trust as truth, which is the teachings of a realized master, not imaginations out of my own head. Anyway, I just wanted to ask your perspective on that. It seems strange, I guess, because I'm one of the people who's doing that very thing that I'm recognizing is just a bunch of BS on my part. I don't know about other people, and I don't know where they're getting their direction from. But I do know on my part, coming from an unawakened state or an unenlightened state, and telling you how to become enlightened seems to be foolish. And so, what's your perspective on that?
Thanks, Lynn. That's a great question. So I hold everything lightly, even the idea of someone who is fully realized and someone who is, I used to jokingly say that there are two kinds of people, those that have admitted that they're awake and those who haven't admitted it yet. And so in my perspective, everyone has contact with truth, and their truth is as true as everyone else's. And so we're all here, we all can share. Of course, there are different degrees of realization, and any interaction will be, as I was just saying about the main thing that will affect other people is your own state of realization. And so there will be limits, and some people will be. And it's also very dynamic and contextual in each moment. Sometimes you'll be more awake in a moment than your teacher, and than even a so-called fully realized being. And so we all have that opportunity here to share, and there's no reason, I think, to not share, to not offer our wisdom, our truth, at every point in the journey. And I'll share something that one of my teachers, Adyashanti, shared with me when he kind of, I was actually already teaching, but he kind of, he we had a discussion once where I kind of told him I didn't think I really needed to come to his retreats anymore, and he said, "Yeah, you're right." And he said he decided to share with me some of what his teacher had shared when she sent him out to teach. And one of the things she really stressed was she said, be careful who you invite to teach. And then she went on to be more specific, and she said that the integrity of the person mattered more than the degree of awakening. And in a lot of spiritual circles, I think we might think it's the other way around. That if somebody was profoundly had profound experiences, profound realizations, that would be the most important thing, and that somehow magically integrity would follow. But in my experience and in all my observation of other teachers and other students and their reports of experience, the integrity is the key. It's how much transparency there is. How much the person actually speaks from and teaches from their own direct experience. And when that's there, then it's perfectly fine. If there's an aspect of a question that comes up, an aspect of experience that they're not in full realization of, they'll just honestly say it. They'll just say, "I don't really know anything about that," or or, "Hey, let's explore this together. Let's see if we can find a teaching or a teacher or a book or a source that answers that question." And or there's a great story about Gandhi, that one time a woman came to him with her son, And she said, "Gandhi, you have to help me. My son has this horrible addiction to sugar. He just eats sweets all day long, and it's really starting to affect his health. Please, please, Gandhi, can you help us?" And so Gandhi told her, "Yes, yes, absolutely, I will help you. But can you please come back in 2 weeks?" And the mother said, "Okay, I guess, yeah, we'll come back in 2 weeks." And so she came back in 2 weeks. And she brought her son again, and this time Gandhi took her son aside and gave him a very spirited, instruction and suggestion that he absolutely needed to just cut sugar out, and that was that. And when he was done, the mother went to Gandhi and said, "Thank you so much, but I can't help myself. I have to ask, why couldn't you have told him that 2 weeks ago?" And Gandhi said, "Oh, well, 2 weeks ago I had not given up sugar yet." And so he had to give up sugar before he would tell someone else to do it. And so that's a beautiful little example of that integrity in action. So, again, because we can't help but be affecting people. And if you are in that role as a teacher, there will naturally be those who are drawn to you. And if you treat them with respect, if you honor their truth, honor their value and consciousness, their inherent divinity, but you don't have all the answers, that's fine. And that's so much better than someone who has had such profound experiences and yet has hasn't, there's another framework for speaking about this, and it's from Ken Wilber, and he talks about how in his explorations he's discovered that it's important not only to wake up, but also to grow up. And that if somebody has woken up but hasn't actually grown up, then it's actually kind of a dangerous imbalance. And similarly, someone can have grown up, have really developed their integrity, developed their functionality as a caring and responsible person, and then they need to develop more realization, more recognition of the truth. So I hope that gives you something to work for. And I guess, I'll share one other story, which is a really great story. When I was studying massage, this was 30 years ago, I was a massage therapist, and when I first was studying it, there was this couple that ran the massage school. And they had chosen early on to, for one of them, to split up the types of massage that they would each study so that they could bring those bodies of knowledge to their school. And so the husband had studied shiatsu and oriental massage, and the wife had studied more polarity therapy. And then they would come home. This was in their process of learning, and they would come home and share notes, and they would had this dilemma kept coming up where the husband would say, "Well, this point is for the liver," and the wife would say, no, "That's a point for, balancing the kidneys." And they started getting confused and wondering, like, "Well, wait a minute, what's this all about? Who, if there's so many contradictions, how can you even trust anything?" And fortunately, they had a teacher. He's a Zen master, and they went to him with this dilemma, and he totally put their mind at ease. He said that ultimately the body makes use of your treatment in whatever way it needs to make use of your treatment, and so that it didn't really matter whether you thought you were treating the kidney or you thought you were treating the liver, that the body in its own wisdom would know what to do with that stimulus, and would use it in a healing means. And so I think the same thing applies with spiritual teachers and spiritual teaching, that there also is a inherent safety net, you could call it, that ultimately we are all responsible for our own spiritual unfolding. And we are all capable of that discrimination. I've spoken a lot here in this group about how the truth is what opens your heart and quiets your mind, and how that is the actual, you could call it the Satguru, our own inner response. And so, whether you're the teacher or the student, when in every moment you can also listen to your own heart and notice whether something is really true in that moment for you, including up to and including this question of whether it's true for you right now to be teaching, and which really opens your heart, which really quiets your mind. Does your work as a teacher, as when you're sharing these pointers, whether they're your own or someone else's, does it seem to have that effect? And ultimately, the biggest definition of truth is what opens the most hearts the most amount of time. What allows the most presence to be experienced. And so it's not even just, what feels true for you, but just what allows that experience to be felt by anyone and everyone who you interact with. And that's a dynamic, always changing question: what's true in this moment? Sometimes, back to the whole question of helping, sometimes really all you can do is hold someone's hand, or give them give someone on the side of the road some money, or something very simple, very practical. And yet that's what allows it just in that moment allows your heart to open, allows their heart to open. Much more than if you try to talk to them about, find out who you really are. And in that moment, that would be, it wouldn't be something. They're hungry. They may need that, some food more than they need that answer. So Lynn wrote that was a perfect answer, so that's great. I do. I was, and you're right, Lynn. When you raised your hand, I was just going to launch into a little discussion. And so, since I'm not seeing any other hands up or questions, I'll just say a little bit more about death, and about this opportunity to use. It's a funny way to say it, but to use the experience of death or dying to go more deeply into the truth. Another means of discriminating the truth. I mentioned, this very visceral kind of kinesthetic way of sensing, noticing the response of your heart, of your being, noticing that expansion and softening that is natural in response to something that's more true, and or noticing when it contracts, when it shuts down, as an indication that something is less true or not very true for you at all in that moment. And so you can follow that in a sort of direct sensing way. But there's also a very simply a kind of logical way to view the truth. And that is that the longer something lasts, the more real, the more true it is. And the shorter something lasts, the less true, the less real it is. And so anything that has a very short lifespan, existence span, whatever you want to call it, it's not that it's false or fake or bad or anything like that. It's just not a very full container of the truth, not a very persistent one, not a very lasting one. And so a simple, really simple example is a thought. Our thoughts don't last very long. In fact, they fly by very quickly, and sometimes you can't even recall them because they pass by. And even if you recall them, you can't actually think them the same way anymore. You can't think the same thought twice. And so these are very, very small containers of truth. And the evidence is that they don't last very long. And then in contrast, something like an emotion, a feeling. Often when a really strong feeling gets triggered, it lasts. Often much longer than just a simple passing thought. And in fact, sometimes a feeling gets triggered, and then whatever is triggering it is suddenly realized not to be actually like you think you see a snake in the path, and your heart starts racing, and then you realize that it's just a stick. But it takes a while for your heart to stop racing and for you to get over the being stirred up like that. And if it's a really intense experience, my wife and I were hiking yesterday, and very shortly after we got on the trail, we came upon some dogs that were off their leash, and then we couldn't see the owner, and then we looked over, and the owner was lying unconscious on the side of the trail and was unresponsive. We couldn't wake him. And so we called 911, and the fire department came. They eventually got a helicopter to take him to the hospital. And what was kind of interesting was that it was actually my wife and another friend and myself, and we were all very calm, and we were just dealing with the phone and trying to do what little we could until the firemen got there, and then we handled the dogs and got the dogs back out to the parking lot, and they had called the Humane Society. But eventually the guy woke up and was able to tell them his name, and they got the owner of the dogs to come. And so it kind of as well as it could turn out, it turned out to be okay. But what was fascinating to me was, like I said, we were relatively calm through the whole experience. And then 2 hours later, I sat down to meditate. And as I sat there to meditate, some of the images, some of the memories of what had just occurred came up, and there were all these very, very quick but very cleansing kind of emotional releases. And tears started streaming down my face, and I shook, and everything kind of just, and it just, so again, it's like the emotional process unfolded over a much longer time frame. And so that's, like I said, so now we're up to something that lasts as long as an emotion, but obviously emotions are not that long lasting. I mean, they come and go fairly quickly. And so then there are things like our body. And our body is, you could call it a truer illusion. It lasts, ideally for many decades. And it has this persistence, this, again, relatively more truth, more reality, even though ultimately it is pure illusion. It is my definition of illusion is something real that appears to be something other than what it is. And so, there are things like bodies that last much, much longer than any particular thought or feeling. And then, of course, if you have experienced it, you may have a sense that there is a soul or an essence or a beingness that lasts much longer than the body. Possibly many hundreds or thousands of lifetimes, who knows really how the whole journey unfolds. And so that, your soul, your essence, in this definition, is much more real than your body because it lasts longer. But here's the thing, even when we get up to something like that, like our soul, our essence, that lasts, amazingly long amount of time. There's a fundamental principle at work here, which is anything that has form or name, anything that you can name, anything that has a particular form, particular shape, particular quality, particular individuality, like even obviously a body, but also even a soul or a personal essence, anything like that that has form is also ultimately an illusion and also ultimately dissolves. Ultimately, all form is temporary. So even the most profound and real and true and long-lasting aspects of our being, if there are aspects of our being that come and go, then eventually they go. And then what's left, for lack of a better word, you could call the source. It's the source, the formless, the source of all that illusion. And so that, to say it never goes because it never comes. it has no qualities. And so it is the one kind of truth, you could say, that lasts forever, that is always, always true. And now here's the thing. Anytime a particular form dissolves, and this is actually true if you can catch it, it's not so obvious with something simple like a thought, but it's actually true when a thought ends. And it can sometimes even be more obvious with something like a really strong feeling, that when it finally truly is released, then there is a spaciousness. And so what I was starting to say is that anytime something with form or name is dissolved, that in that moment immediately following the ending of something, there is a taste, a glimpse of the absolute, of the source, of the formless. And it may just be the contrast, you know, just like how quiet it sounds when you when the stereo's been blasting and blasting and blasting, and then you turn it off and it's like, whoa, it sounds so silent. It's so quiet. It's like almost eerily quiet, you know. And so the same thing happens whenever there is an end to form. And this is true, like I said, it's true in a simple way, like when you drop something and it breaks, and there's like this moment where suddenly there's less form. There's a little window, you could say, a little opening, a little arising of the formless. Especially if you're able to be really present to the ending of that form. And so again, emotions when they end, relationships when they end. That's a, you know, that's usually a fairly challenging one, when especially a close romantic or marriage, close romantic relationship or marriage ends, and there's this, whoa, there's like this big empty space, this big formless kind of quality to your experience. And so every time there's one of these, you could call them a death. It's a death of something. It's an end of something. It's a loss of something. There is this opening into the absolute, into the underlying reality. And so, you know, the woman who wrote the question this week, you know, had, you know, was feeling drawn to helping her, the people she's close to, with their upcoming transitions. It's like, that is very, very powerful work. It's a very powerful thing to be around anyone who is dying, or, I mean, either in a general sense of, you know, working through the stages of dying, or literally to be present right there in the room when someone leads their body, because there is this opening that happens. And of course, for the person who is dying, that opening is, I mean, profound is not a profound enough word for the experience. And I'm going to totally paraphrase, and I'm not an expert in Tibetan Buddhism, but my slight understanding of it is that everyone at the moment of physical death, because of this profound falling away of form. I mean, it's such a strong container of form. It's such a strong experience of being the body that, in their view, everyone at the moment of physical death is given a total experience of their absolute nature, of the ultimate reality. It's like, because it's such a profound transition, they are catapulted into an experience of their true nature, beyond all concepts, beyond all form. And the only question is, can they hang out there? Can they hold in their consciousness that absolute reality? And if they can't, if they can, then in the Tibetan tradition, they are truly, fully, completely liberated. Because if you don't blink, even when you die, if you don't resist at all, even when you go from the experience of a body to the experience of absolute reality, then you are, in a sense, it's proven, it's demonstrated that you are free, that you are liberated, that nothing else, anything short of that isn't going to shake you if that doesn't shake you. And so if you can just go with the experience of physical death, then you are free. And if you can't, then that's when, it gets much more complicated in the Tibetan system, and there are all these different levels of reality, and basically they keep toning it down. Consciousness keeps toning down its reality until you can handle it. And at a certain point, if you can't even like sort of hang out in one of the lesser bardos, then you start the process of reincarnation, because you obviously need to practice some more the process of letting go, the process of letting things be, even letting everything go. Now, like I said, that's a very rough paraphrase of part of the truth in Tibet Buddhism. But I think the wonderful thing about the kind of non-dual traditions that I'm more familiar with is that they, in essence, they suggest that you don't have to wait until you physically die. That by becoming very present to the impermanence of everything, to all of these smaller openings into emptiness, into spaciousness, into true nature, that happen all day long with again, like I said, to a very slight degree with the passing of every thought. Where do the thoughts go when they subside? And the passing of every feeling, and the ending of every relationship, the ultimate ending of every possession. And so even though physical death, either your own, and by the way, this applies when you're around someone who dies, because in a sense you're losing your relationship. You're losing your opportunity to be with that person in form, in the particular form of the body. And so, it's both an opportunity for the person dying and for the person being with someone who's dying to embrace, invite, accept, allow, be curious about that emptiness that appears whenever anything ends. But again, the good news is that you don't have to, you don't have to become a hospice worker or wait until, you're either, suddenly or not so suddenly facing your own death. Because this process of illusion dissolving, of things ending, of form dissolving back into formlessness, is happening with every breath. You can notice the end of each inhalation, the end of each exhalation, you can notice, more, again, when they occur, more profound things that come to an end. Your role as a parent. That same Zen master who told my friends that, the body uses whatever healing modality it uses for its own purposes anyways. He also used to often say that the last job of a parent is to stop being a parent. That it's actually a job and you have to do it. You have to be the one that stops being a parent. You can't wait for your kids to rebel or something like that. You have to resign. Hand in your letter of resignation and stop being their parent. And that is a kind of death. Different people have different degrees of investment, identity, identification with the role of parent. But probably for every parent, it's a bit of a shock. Even the first time their child goes off by themselves to play, or their child, their teenager goes away for the weekend on their own. It's like, whoa, there's like, what do they call it? The empty nest syndrome when they go away to college. And so that's a kind of death. It's a death of a particular role. And so if you are curious about it, if you have this passion for discovering the truth that underlies all of the form, then you will look, you can even get to a point where you look forward to the endings. Regina shared how she cried when she dropped off her child at college the first time, because that was the end of the mother role. That's the right recognition, and that she had enjoyed that role. But now, of course, she has a friend. What was her child is now her friend. And again, that's so often, what arises in that death, in that emptiness, in that space, is what we would call birth. Something new appears in the space that the death or loss created. And so that's also an opportunity to see the creative aspect of the mystery of the emptiness. That it also is, I said another word for it, is source. And so, it isn't just a process of dying, it's also a process of being born, a process of life, expanding and exploding into existence before it then drops the form and goes back into its underlying true nature. So that's a pretty broad topic. I think we got about as far out with death and dying as we could get today. And so I'll wrap up for today. And I see someone's asking what to title to give this talk. We could call it death and the dissolving of form into the formless. And someone just wrote, "Who is speaking?" I don't know whether that's a self-inquiry question or whether she doesn't know who I am. Here's I'm Nirmala, and I'm done. This is the end of my hour. I look forward to being with you all again next week. Yeah, death and the dissolving of form into the formless. That's correct for the title. So I really enjoyed being here, and I look forward to joining with you all again next Wednesday. Bye for now.